So this is the second day of our Kameter session, and yesterday during Doksan with one of the folks here, the topic of the what we called the human condition came up. I thought I might go into this today and maybe even bring up a koan, a wonderful and quite difficult koan from the Mumon Khan to shed some light on this human condition. So this human condition, we all have it, we all know it, but it would be quite difficult to explain exactly what it is. I thought maybe we could look at some of the teachings of Zen Buddhism to try to get a better fix on this human condition, how pervasive it is, how long-lasting it is. So I was going to mention the six realms of existence. Now, Norma has gone into this in great detail. One or two years ago, she spent several months going through each one of these realms one by one, and we'll go over them now, just kind of as an overview. So just starting with the supra-human realms, you have the God realm. You then, just below that, have the Asura, or fighting demon realm. Then you have the human realm. And then you have the animal realm, the hungry ghost realm, and the hell realm. So let's just look at these realms for a moment and see if they can shed some light on this human realm and the human condition. So each of these realms has at its core a certain sense of what, for want of a better word, I would use the word lack, sense of lack, something's lacking. And each of these realms has its own unique approach to this sense of lacking, its own unique way of trying to fill that lack, eliminate that lack. So if we look, for example, at the God realm or the heaven realm, what lack does someone in the heaven realm have? They have everything. They're handsome or beautiful, intelligent, peaceful. They have all the material things that anyone might desire in spades, so to speak. What do they lack? Well, in this realm, they lack the sense coming from something dimly recognized, even in spite of their intelligence, that what they have and all the things upon which they base their happiness and their self-worth is temporary, impermanent. As the Buddha put it, all component things are subject to decay. And they know this on some deep level, dimly seen. So in spite of everything they have, they still have a profound sense of lack hidden away. And how do they approach this lack? What do they do about it? Well, in this realm, what they do is they accumulate and they defend. It's not enough to have everything. You need to have even more, because deep inside is the fear that what you have won't be enough at some point. It will be taken away from you. It will disappear. It will no longer satisfy you. And at the same time, you must defend yourself. So, you know, we have the example in the actual real world of multi-billionaires who, despite their immense wealth and power and the ability to do anything, go anywhere, own anything, control large numbers of people. Yet they want to accumulate more, and at the same time feel threatened by people who have very little or nothing. This is the heaven realm. Now the Asura realm, or the fighting demon realm, is a little below this realm. These are also very powerful individuals. They have many skills and abilities, but there's a sense of lack there. The lacking here is more acutely felt. They have power, but the fruits of this power, the happiness from this power, are going to someone else, and that's not right. And it shouldn't be that way. And this is felt, again, as a profound sense of lack. But the way that they respond to this lack is with anger, with outrage, with often violence, and they're very, very good at it, and they're very powerful. Now, if we were to go to the other end of these six realms, go to this, what is called sometimes the subhuman realms, let's look at the realm of the hungry ghosts. It's just below, let's look at first at the animal realm. So what is the animal realm? What lack do animals feel? Well, they feel hunger, they feel cold, they feel threat. You ever look out the window in the dead of winter and wonder how animals cope with the terrible conditions outside? The snow, the ice, the wind? How do they do it? They don't have a sense of safety. They don't have a sense that the future is taken care of. They don't have Social Security. They don't have Medicare. They don't have insurance policies. They have to survive by their wits, by their inborn abilities. And in this realm, they react instinctively. So it's not so much the intelligence of figuring out this versus that option and what might be best down the road. It's a very moment-by-moment kind of reflex reaction to life. Now, of course, all these realms reflect on aspects of the human condition. So in this realm, this, you might call this the realm of fascism, the realm of totalitarianism, the realm where people who feel powerless, who feel threatened on all sides, want to be told what to do, what to believe. They want things to be very black and white. Someone's threatening them and someone else will protect them. They want to make such a strong affiliation with something in a position of absolute power that they're willing to do almost anything to save themselves from the sense of this lack, this profound sense of threat surrounding them. This is the animal realm. Now, if we were to look at the hungry ghost realm, just below that realm, the lack here is pervasive. It's a lack of what? Of love? Of things? It takes many, many different forms. And the solution to it is to cry out, to want, to desire intensely, to beg, to plead, to feel that you can never fill this emptiness. Even if you get what it is you think you want, it will never fill this terrible, terrible lack. Now, you might call this the realm of addiction. Are there any of us that don't have some understanding, some feeling, some actual experience of this realm? This is part of the spectrum of our existence. And then you have the hell realm, where the lack is there, like all the other realms, profound lack. It's perhaps even a lack of a sense of self, of center, of any kind of safety, and the response to it is to give up. There's no hope, despair. There's no point in even doing anything. So this is certainly the realm of what one might call depression, despair, nihilism, anarchism, wanton destruction, because there's nothing here worth going for. It's all hopeless. Now let's creep back up to what is called the human realm. The realm that we spend most of our time in, and the realm from the standpoint of Zen Buddhism and Buddhism in general, is the only realm or condition, the human condition from which one can become liberated, one can achieve awakening, one can see into true nature. Now, what is this realm? What makes it so unique? Yes, there's a sense of lack, like all the other realms. There's a sense of lack, sense that something is missing. Often we don't know quite what it is, but we know it's there. There's something lacking in me. There's something lacking about me. Perhaps others have it, but I don't have it. Maybe I was just born that way. And there's a fear that perhaps one will never get this, whatever it is that one lacks. And what is the unique approach of this realm? This is quite interesting. What is the unique approach of the human realm? It's different than all the other realms. It's the willingness to engage in magical thinking. It's the willingness to create a myth. The willingness to name things and make those names real, and then affiliate with them in order to make oneself less alone, less lonely, less separated. So one might say the most profound lack, the most painful thing that a human being can feel is separation in all the forms it takes, including loneliness, grieving the death of a loved one, being shunned, being rejected. Rejection sensitivity is a unique aspect of this realm. Now look at teenagers when they go on social media. Teenagers can become so despairing over flames on this media, over trolls that are attacking them or exposing some personal weakness that they believe they have, that they can even go to the point of killing themselves, because it engenders in the human being a profound sense of despair, sense of rejection, sense of non-affiliation. Everybody else is on that side of the line and I'm alone on this side of the line. And out of this, both sense of lack, the fear of this lack, the belief in this lack, and our propensity as human beings to engage in magical thinking, we create religions. We believe in nationalism. We believe in flags, in tribes. This is how we seek to fill or remove or cover up this lack. Now, why did it end up this way? Why is it so pervasive? How did it get that way? Well, the only thing you can say is, like everything else, that's how it evolved. It wasn't a mistake. It's cause and effect. One thing leads to another, leads to another. Now, if you look at earlier forms of life, look at the apes, just prior to the human evolution. If you were to, for example, look at chimpanzee populations, the chimpanzee is the closest animal to the human, genetically. I think there's only maybe 2 or 2.5% difference in the genome between a chimpanzee and a human being. And if you observe chimpanzee populations, the time you see them react most intensely, with most rage, with devastating violence, is when a non-tribal chimpanzee enters their area. A chimpanzee that they can't detect as one of their own, and perhaps they do this both through vision and smell, I'm not sure exactly how, but when, accidentally perhaps, a chimpanzee enters their realm, they will tear this chimpanzee apart life and limb. They'll pull their arms and legs off and attack them viciously. And this is our immediate, you might say, forebearer on the evolutionary tree. Now, when the chimpanzee evolved into a human form at some point, perhaps 2 million years ago, there was a continued evolution, and then we had, actually at some point, it is believed 6 different kinds of humans with the genera Homo, H-O-M-O, Homo meaning human. So we had Homo erectus, and then Homo Neanderthal, and several others, some of which existed all at the same time. And yet, while there were Neanderthals and Devonesians and Homo sapiens, which is our particular species, on the Earth at the same time, one species persisted, Homo sapiens. Now, why is this? Was it our, perhaps, evolved ability to affiliate, to create larger and larger groups based on myth, and thereby be able to overwhelm smaller tribes of other humanoid species who are no match for 100, 200 of us who all bought into the same myth, believed the same thing, affiliated in the same way. So we survived. And we have the human condition, for better or worse. So we have the human condition. What does this practice here, this what we call Zen, which, as I've pointed out before, comes from the Sanskrit word dhyana, meaning absorption. What does this practice of absorption, of mindfulness, of attentiveness, how does this shed light upon and enable us to both utilize our human condition and transcend at the same time our human condition? How does that work? Let's take a look at a koan from the Mumon Kan. Now, this koan is, interestingly, and I'm not sure exactly how Hakuin came up with this, but one of the 8 or so koan in the Mumon Kan that Hakuin described as particularly difficult, particularly steep, particularly hard to sink one's teeth into, to ferret out the deep meaning of, to break through, to see through. See through it. Why? Does it throw more sand in our eyes? Is it profound in its understanding of our human condition that it's hard for us to see that because we're subject to it? Well, he called this one of the Nanto, N-A-N-T-O, one of the Nanto koan, and I'll read it to you. And this is number 31 on the Mumon Kan. And the title of it is, Joshu Sees Through the Old Woman. So it goes like this, is the case. A monk of Joshu's, and once again, Joshu was a very famous Tang Dynasty master. He was a master of what they call lips and tongue Zen. In other words, he didn't so much shout and hit and shock. He used his words in very subtle ways. People said that when he talked, it was almost as if light was emanating from his mouth. He was a master of great profundity, and he lived to a very, very ripe old age and had hundreds and hundreds of enlightened disciples. So a monk of Joshu's asked an old woman on the way to Mount Gotai. Now let's just stop here and say a little bit about Mount Gotai. So Mount Gotai actually is a place in China. It exists today. It's actually a mountain that has five peaks. It has a north, south, east, west, and central peak. And each of these peaks is a plateau. And on these plateaux are monasteries and lamaseries, as many as 20 of them, actually. And this is a site of pilgrimage for Buddhists from very long ago, even back here in the Tang Dynasty and perhaps before that. And even, I believe, today, there are still monasteries and lamaseries on Mount Gotai. So this was a place, you might call it like the Woodstock of Buddhism. A place where you could go and find lots of different monasteries, teachers, monks, lectures, teishos, styles of practice. So that you could kind of pick and choose or test yourself against them. But here it is, wanting to go to this Mount Gotai. There's still something. The human being that needs this needs to go to Mount Gotai. So a monk of Joshu's asked an old woman the way to Mount Gotai. Now, stop again, and I hate to tease you this way, but this old woman, let's just get this out of the way, and then we're going to go on right after this. What is then this old woman? Now, you have to understand when you approach a koan like this that there are certain idioms, I guess you could say, in the language, that if you understand them, you can get things even a little better. Now, the old woman in many of these koan is a very wise old woman. Now, back at this time, I don't believe there were many, if any, female Zen masters. That was a byproduct of a certain kind of prejudice, perhaps, against women back then that, thank God, we don't have today. That's a joke. But the old woman, there were many women who were quite enlightened, but they had to teach in a more surreptitious way. And why would they teach? Perhaps from a sense of deep compassion. And these women were, in the Zen literature, both feared and revered. So a monk of Joshu asked an old woman the way to Mount Gotai. She said, "Go straight on." After the monk had taken three or five steps, she said, "He may look like a fine monk, but he too goes off like that." That is, like all the rest, or look at this person, you know, he's wearing robes, perhaps a student of the great master Joshu's, and done lots and lots of practice, but look how he goes. Afterwards, another monk told Joshu about this. So the first monk went back and told Joshu this story. I wonder how he might have told the story. And then a second monk told Joshu this story. How do you think they told him the story? Is it interesting, or were they stung? They feel embarrassed, humiliated. Remember this human condition. It affects all of us, even long-term practitioners. So this wonderful Master Joshu said, "Wait a bit, I'll go and investigate that old woman for you." The next day, off he went and asked her the same question and got the same reply. On returning, Joshu announced to his assembly of monks, "I've seen through the old woman of Mount Gotai for you." And that's the case. You can see why this is a Nanto koan. So how do we approach a koan like this? One of the very first thing we need to do when we have a koan that we are working on or wanting to glean some wisdom from is to ask ourselves, what is this really about? Why is this here? What is the point of this? What is this story pointing at? Well, we talked a lot about the human condition in the various realms and the sense of lack that is so pervasive, and how different realms will approach this lack. And in the human realm, this fear of non-affiliation, of aloneness, of lacking something profound that perhaps one must hide from others, that others all have but I don't. Our approach to it is to aggrandize ourselves perhaps with affiliation, with credentials. I'm a student of Joshu's. I've done a lot of Zen practice. I've passed this many koan. Very pervasive. This is a human condition. Did this old woman know that? What was her reason for saying what she said? Why would she, in a sense, bully or tease or seek out some soft spot in these monks who are innocently asking her the directions to Mount Gotai? What was her reason for doing this? Where was she coming from? And what about Joshu? What does he mean he saw through the old woman? He went there and asked the same question and got the same answer. What does he mean see through? What is this seeing through? And what does he mean I've seen through the old woman of Mount Gotai for you? Seen through or for you? It's kind of like in Christianity they say Jesus died on the cross for your sins. Can he see through someone for you? Let's for a moment just step back and take a look. I want to read to you something from, and I may not have pulled it out yet. Hang on. Perhaps I didn't bring it. Oh, here it is. Okay. So this is a wonderful book by Chong Trungpa. He's dead now. He was a lama, a great master of Tibetan Buddhism. He had his problems. He had the human condition. But he was really a wonderful teacher, and actually my former teacher, many of our former teacher, Richard Clark, at some point spent some time with Chong Trungpa. I was very impressed with him, especially his ability to explain things about this human condition and how they affect our practice. One book that he wrote was Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. And another book is called The Myth of Freedom. And that one I'm going to read you now is from The Myth of Freedom. I want you to think about it in terms of this koan, in terms of the human condition, in terms of how humans want to affiliate, want to have credentials. So I'll read a little bit of this to you. So he described, he was going into, in a chapter called Boredom, as he went deeply into the boredom side of this practice and how important that is and knowing how to deal with that is and why it's there and why it's so powerful. So he wrote here, sitting and meditating is the little slit in your artery. You may have been told that sitting meditation is extremely boring and difficult to accomplish, but you do not find it at all that difficult. In fact, it seems quite easy. You just sit. The artery, which is the subconscious gossip in your mind, is cut through by using certain techniques, either working on breathing or walking or whatever. It is a very humble gesture on your part. Just sit and cut through your thoughts. Just welcome your breathing going in and out. Just natural breathing, no special breathing. Just sit and develop the watchfulness of your breathing. It is not concentrating on breathing. Concentration involves something to grasp, something to hold on to. You are here trying to concentrate on something there. Rather than concentration, we practice mindfulness. We see what's happening there rather than developing concentration, which is goal-oriented. In mindfulness practice, there's no goal, no journey. You're just mindful of what is happening there. And yes, that's how I sit. Now, he says, there's no promise of love and light or visions of any kind. No angels, no devils. Nothing happens. It is absolutely boring. Sometimes you feel silly. One often asks the question, who's kidding whom? Am I on to something or not? You are not on to something. Traveling the path means you get off everything. There's no place to perch. Sit and feel your breath. Be with it. Then you begin to realize that actually the slitting of the artery did not take place when you were introduced to the practice. He's calling slitting of the artery making a deep and intimate opening to let out things that have been inside, that were hidden inside, to have the courage to do that. That actually slitting the artery did not take place when you were introduced to the practice. The actual slitting takes place when you begin to feel the boredom of the practice, real boredom. Quote, I'm supposed to get something out of Buddhism and meditation. I'm supposed to attain different levels of realization. I haven't. I'm bored stiff. Even your watchers, unsympathetic to you, begins to mock you. Think about this. Begins to mock you. Boredom is important because boredom is anti-credential. Credentials are entertaining, always bringing you something new, something lively, something fantastic, all kinds of solutions. When you take away the idea of credentials, then there is boredom. Very wonderful piece. So coming back to this koan, so this old woman says to the monk, asking her the direction to Mount Gotai, to this place where he's going to learn even more and perhaps gain more credentials. This is a monk from Joshu. Go straight on. Go straight on. And the monk takes 3 or 5 steps and she says, he may look like a fine monk, but he too goes off like that. Wow. All these credentials I thought I had, all this Zen-like approach to circumstances, boldly. Suddenly this was just, she saw through it. She saw my real self. She saw the lack there. What am I going to do? She saw it. The lack that I know is there that I wasn't willing to look at because I was covering it up with credentials. How compassionate, perhaps. But these two of these monks went to Joshu and perhaps complained. You know, Joshu, here we are. We're just innocently asking her how to get to Mount Gotai, and she puts us down. It was very humiliating and very embarrassing. There were other people there, and they heard her say this. And I felt so awkward about it. I don't know what to do. Interesting. So Joshu says, wait a bit and I'll go investigate her for her. So he asks the same question and he gets the same reply. What What's that all about? What does he mean? Or what is his intention by saying this to the monks? I'll go and check her out for you. And going there and doing exactly the same thing. What is he doing now? Isn't he going straight into the lion's den? Isn't he going straight on? Entering this experience, that experience, buffeted left and right, dealing with anxiety, dealing with potential humiliation, but seeing it in a much bigger frame, understanding the compassion underlying this woman's actions. Perhaps even they know each other. Perhaps she knows Joshu. So if she knows Joshu and knows Joshu's a master, why would she give him the same reply? Is she perhaps speaking from a different place that isn't judging, that isn't picking and choosing? Is really some universal truth? Go straight on. And if you get caught by my next statement, perhaps it's something you need to look at. So he says, I've seen through the old woman of Mount Gotai for you. I've seen through her. Now for you. There's a saying in Buddhism, and in Zen in particular, one cut, all cut. See through one thing, all has been seen through. If you truly, genuinely see through your separation, your sense of lack, if you see through it, in other words, it doesn't block you. You're able to see through it. Yes, it's there. Yes, it's there, but it doesn't block you. It doesn't obscure your truth. You can see through it. Now, perhaps even like seeing through a pair of glasses. I'm wearing glasses right now. I am seeing through these glasses. Yes, they're in front of my eyes, but they don't block my vision. But even more interestingly, they correct my vision. How interesting. I can see through them and they help me. I've seen through this old woman for you. So the commentary goes like this. The old woman just sat still in her tent and planned the campaign, yet she is not aware of the bandits stealing into the tent. Old Joshu was clever enough to steal into her camp and menace her fortress, but he wasn't a real general. Pondering over the matter, we must say that they both had their faults. Tell me now, what was Joshu's insight into the old woman? And this is a lot of sand being thrown in the eyes here. One of the reasons this koan is difficult. Now we're going to not go into the other aspects of this commentary, but what was Joshu's insight into the old woman? This is the key here. What was his insight? What was his insight into the whole story? Into picking himself up and going there physically, not just explaining to the monks, but doing it, entering it, being it, putting himself in the line of fire. What is this? What's he doing? What was his insight? What was it that enabled him to come back and say, I've seen through the old woman of Mount Gotai for you? So the verse goes this way. The question is the same each time. The answer, too, is the same. Sand in the rice, thorns in the mud. Question and answer are the same. Are they really the same? Sand in the rice, thorns in the mud. So what is this seeing through? Yes, we have the human condition. That's our birthright. It evolved. How could it be otherwise? Yes, I am a human being. I'm a human being and human beings are like that. I have a human mind and human minds are like that. Yes, I do feel pain when rejection happens, when a bully picks on my weak points. Yes, that's true. And yet what? How does this practice of absorption help you with this. In this practice of absorption, something is there, but the dividing line is gone. Something is heard, but no hearing is taking place. Something is seen, but no seeing is taking place. Something is known, but no knowing is taking place. There's no separating from anything. It's seen as one big, vast fabric. Yes, it's there, but at the same time, it doesn't block a you. Remember that saying by Yaiko Iwasaki? At the time she became deeply enlightened, this was a 27-year-old Japanese girl dying of TB, she said, "What a relief to discover that just as I am, I lack nothing. Just as I am, I lack nothing. Because I am shining this one thing, lacks and all, difficulties and all. I am shining this one thing." Another Zen practitioner said after his awakening, he said, "How wonderful for me to have realized that just to be is a supremely total act. Just to be is a supremely total act." I'll leave you with one last little story. This is from a Zen master. This is very short. One of the styles of Zen teaching when working with koan is for the teacher, and this is not done anymore, I believe, because most students don't have the intense faith and willingness to accept any degree of humiliation, any degree of rejection without quitting, without stopping, to keep going and going and going. But many, many years ago, in the heyday of Zen, students had this kind of spirit. So masters could get away with rejecting every answer, no matter what it was, whether it was on the path, not on the path, whether they were getting something, whether it was some small awakening, even a larger awakening. No, 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 that's not it. So this particular Zen master who wrote a little autobiography said this, this is just brief. "Nevertheless, every time I tried to answer my master's question, I was always told that something was still lacking in me. One day in meditation, the word lacking came into my mind, and suddenly I felt my body and mind open wide from the core of my marrow and bone, through and through. The feeling was as though old piled-up snow was suddenly melting away under the bright sun that had emerged after many dark and cloudy days. I could not help but laugh out heartily. I jumped down from my seat, caught Master Meng Shan's arm, and said to him, 'Tell me, what do I lack? What do I lack?' The master slapped my face thrice, and I prostrated myself before him three times. He said, 'Oh, Taishan, it has taken you several years to get here.'" So we'll end there today.